your host, Lauren Meltzer. Our topic for tonight is Education Strikes Back. This past week, the California University students, faculty, and public said no to austerity measures, rallied against economic inequity, and mobilized the discourse of the Occupy movements. In some ways, similar to the last few years, but in other ways, a historic week. Indeed, California's commitment to higher education has cratered. Recent years of budget cuts, state university faculty layoffs, and steep tuition hikes are starting to take their toll on the long-term health of the state. To what degree has the state's university system been in peril? What is the administration up against? And what larger issues might this link to in terms of a crisis point in education? Joining me to answer these questions are, in studio, I have Weiming Dariatis. Good evening, Weiming. You are assistant professor of Asian American Studies and specializing in Asian American of mixed heritage, Asian American art and literature, and ethnic studies, composition writing as empowerment. And you also serve as the president of the SFSU chapter of California Faculty Association since June 1st.
That's correct.
Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And then also by phone, we have two wonderful guests, Wendy Brown, the class of 1936 professor of political science at University of California, Berkeley, and co-chair of the Berkeley Faculty Association, an independent association of UCB faculty members. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
And Laurel Rosenhall, reporter who covers higher education for the Sacramento Bee, and you can read her work at sacbee.com. Good evening, Lauren. Laurel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we also had a representative from the University of California Office of the President scheduled to join us tonight, but unfortunately, she had to cancel. But of course, we will be taking calls from you, so please give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, thank you to all my guests tonight. I think I'll start with Laurel Rosenhall this evening. Laurel, could you give us kind of a summary of what's happened this week, this historic week?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a confluence of several factors. There are students across the state who are fed up with tuition increases in both of the state's public university systems. Tuition has basically doubled in the last 5 years and tripled in the last 10 years. There are also faculty and other employees of the university systems who are really fed up with budget cuts they've been experiencing in recent years. There are union and management disputes in the California State University that are further inflaming it. And then there's also the Occupy movement that's happening across the country and I think is really salient on the campuses where these financial issues have become of such importance to students and employees.
And so it's funny because it seems like over and again this week we've seen this repetition of the leaders, the chancellors, and whatnot, deciding to use police to stop what should be a right of the students, this freedom of speech, and use police, and then ending up in situations that everyone thinks is just intolerable. Why does it keep happening over and again?
Well, I don't know. There seems to be some shifting tactics on the university campuses. Some of them are letting the protests go forward for a night or two, an encampment, but then cracking down. I know last week at UC Berkeley, we saw that the police came in the middle of the night, which led to a much less fight on the part of the protesters and much less coverage on the part of the media. The incident that happened at UC Davis last week happened at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon in broad daylight with many, many people present on campus. All the protesters were awake. Many people who were observing had their cell phone cameras in their pockets. And then it was a Friday afternoon preceding the weekend when the news channels had two full days to replay the video that so many of us have watched and been pretty surprised by. So I don't know that there's necessarily one specific reason for the crackdowns, but I think that the different responses are leading to different amounts of public awareness of what's going on.
And do you think, as a reporter, do you think that, from your perspective, that these protests have been able to accomplish what the students and faculty set out to accomplish?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. It has raised a lot of awareness about the budget cuts on the campuses and the tuition increases. On the other hand, it hasn't led to any concrete change in the state's fiscal policy, and we're looking at probably another $200 million cuts to the two university systems next month. We have not heard a word from our governor on this issue, so we don't know where he stands in terms of the protests or whether it will change his decision to put these trigger cuts in place next month. So it's hard to say how much they're achieving, other than certainly there is a huge amount of public awareness that there wasn't maybe 3 weeks ago.
And how long have you been covering kind of the Sacramento beat and political scene? Is this something you've
been covering? Well, I've been covering higher education for 3 years, and I've been covering state politics just for a couple of months.
Okay. So have you seen, has this been normal in terms of the kind of response, to your point, that the governor, or lack of response, that the governor's given?
Well, you know, in 2009, Schwarzenegger was meeting with students. There were many protests about tuition on the campuses in 2009 following a couple of years of budget cuts and tuition increases. And Schwarzenegger did meet with students, invite them to the Capitol, and did come out the following January with a budget proposal that had an almost 10% increase in funding for the university systems. His chief of staff was quoted in the New York Times at the time saying that the protests were kind of the tipping point for him, that he felt that, you know, there needed to be a change, a pattern change. So That was different, but it did take a while before that changed.
Okay.
Might I add something here?
Yes.
This is Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi. It's really just a response to your question about whether one can see some effectiveness in the large rallies that students are having now. And it's complicated because, of course, each time there's police violence, the shift focuses to outrage about the police violence, as it must and should. And I would add that, you know, I think part of what we're up against is a post-9/11 paramilitary police training that I think has taken many of the chancellors and university administrators by surprise. Almost all of them, with the exception of the Berkeley chancellor at this point, have taken a very strong stand against what has happened over the last week and have committed themselves to a much less violent response. Or even a nonviolent response to nonviolent protesters in the future. The president of UC has done that. The chancellor at Davis publicly apologized today. The chancellor at Merced went on record saying it would never happen at Merced and so forth. So I think in some ways there's, you know, the police violence has brought a huge amount of attention to the situation. But I want to go back to your question about whether the attention is also going to have an effect on policy. And here's what I want to say. One of the frustrations that many faculty and students who have been engaged in the movement against privatizing public higher education, one of the frustrations we have had over these last 3 years is that we have not felt from our leadership in the CSUs, the CCs, or the University of California especially, we have not felt from our leadership much commitment to a really strong campaign against the deep disinvestment in public higher education. Instead, we've seen a really pretty much a set of strategies going into play immediately as to how to privatize, how to raise tuition, how to get more money from the private sector, how to make deals locally, how to set up new campuses in Shanghai that would be revenue generating and so forth. And this week, that has changed. This week, you have seen. Leaders of the University of California, as well as leaders in the other sectors, making a strong set of statements about the urgent need to rescue public higher education. So that doesn't immediately translate into policy. It doesn't reverse Prop 13. It doesn't raise money that digs California out of its fiscal crisis. But it has shifted the discourse, just as Occupy Wall Street has shifted the discourse. So I think that's to be noted amidst all the other things that are going on.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Wendy. I'm curious, from your standpoint, do you think it's just responding to the customer, if you will, who are the students?
Are they mollifying us?
Yeah, do you think it's a wake-up to them?
Sorry. I of course that's part of what's happening, but I also think they've been pushed. I think that what happened, let me just stick with the University of California for a minute, although I want to go on record as saying that I'm really committed to the California Master Plan, and I don't think any of the sectors of the Master Plan, the community colleges, the California State Universities, or the University of California can do without each other. We need each other. We need all three pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But let me speak about UC for a second. I think that, in fact, up until now, the regents and the university president's office have been able to kind of put up with a few demonstrations each time they raise tuition and then raise tuition. And I think they recognize that that is not possible at this threshold. And so, yes, there's a little bit of mollifying and saying what the customer wants to hear. But at the same time, I have seen administrators such as our executive vice chancellor here at Berkeley who just, they don't like to go to Sacramento. They don't like to go to rallies. And they have stood up and they have said, we must rescue public higher education in this state. That is what is at stake. And if that translates into a serious campaign and reorients the university at the top toward trying to figure out how to help Jerry Brown and trying to figure out how to help Democratic legislators run a serious campaign to undo the throttle hold that Proposition 13 has on this state, that makes a different future for the state. And I think, I don't think that's all they're doing right now, but I do think they're being pushed to do that more than they have been in the last 4 years.
Okay. It's Wendy Brown, professor of political science from the University of California, Berkeley. You were going to say something, Laurel.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to respond on the question about whether there is political will to basically create more revenue for the higher education system. Last week, the Public Policy Institute of California released a survey on state residents' views about higher education, and it found that large majorities of Californians think that higher ed is headed in the wrong direction. They think that affording college has become a big problem for students. They think that there's not enough state funding for higher education, and they think that our public colleges and universities have been impacted a lot by budget cuts. However, the very same survey found that there is not a majority support willing to pay higher taxes to maintain even current level funding. So I think that this is not just a problem about university leadership, not doing effective lobbying in the Capitol. I think that there is a kind of societal shift that would have to happen to create more revenue, and this survey in particular doesn't indicate that there is a majority willing to pay taxes, not even a simple majority, let alone a two-thirds majority.
I want to get back to that. That's a really interesting fact. Let me get back to it. Before we continue, I just want to bring Wei Ming Dariotis into the conversation. Wei Ming, you were at Thursday's event, correct?
All day.
Can you tell, from your perspective, can you kind of paint a picture of what was happening?
Let me backtrack a little bit and say that I've lived in San Francisco since I was 4 years old, and I went through public schools during the Prop 13 debacle, and literally saw the degradation of the schools right around me. I've taught at the community college level at Foothill. I've taught at several different of the CSU campuses, including the one I'm at now. I've taught at UC Davis. I've taught at Stanford. So I've pretty much seen the gamut of public higher education in the state of California. And I think that what we're facing is a crisis of understanding. People in the state seem to see public education as a benefit for the individual rather than as a benefit for the society as a whole. And until we make that shift, which I think is the shift that your other guest is mentioning, until we identify and embrace that and understand that public education is a benefit for the society as a whole, then we will, if we don't do that, we will never be able to turn the corner on this crisis. And that's the shift that we need to make as a society. When we talk about, you know, public good, we don't think that, you know, paved roads means that, you know, you're only concerned about the road right in front of your own house, right? We understand that all of these things have to be interconnected. All of the roads have to be paved for us to all benefit as a society. So similarly, I think that we need to make that shift and understand that we have to invest in higher education, not for the benefit of an individual customer, which is how students are being posited right now, but rather for the overall benefit of the society. And we can't leave out the prison system as part of this dialogue. We always, you know, just look at how are we going to invest in public higher education when people are taxed out? Well, there is money being siphoned into the prison system. Why don't we spend more of that on our public education system so that instead of having people not able to fulfill their highest potential, we actually serve the larger good of our society by having folks instead be educated from the ground up rather than being tracked into prisons. You know, why don't we spend the money there? Why don't we pay college professors as much as prison guards get paid?
I mean, do you think that the messaging has been wrong from the universities, or do you think that just the society from a cultural standpoint has changed so that they can't see beyond being an individual?
Part of what
Wendy?
This is Wendy. Uh-huh. Part of what Occupy Wall Street has done, and I think it's important to link it to what's happening with the universities right now, is called attention to what the last 30 years of what we commonly call neoliberalism, but we could just call it free market capitalism, what it has done to public goods, not just what it has done to income inequality and wealth inequalities, but what it has also done in terms of just decimating public goods and the very idea that there are public goods.
And just a pause, when you say public goods to the listeners, what do you mean by that?
Just what the former speaker was talking about, education, infrastructure, libraries, national parks, all the things that we share and value as a public and that exist for the public and that have to be publicly supported, that is, revenue supported through taxation. And for 30 years, we have been increasingly colonized by a mentality in which taxes are understood to be theft and public goods are understood to be better off if they're marketized and individualized. And the higher education system, as we've all three, I think, been saying, is a very specific casualty of that. And when I said earlier that I feel like leaders and stewards and trustees and especially regents of our system have basically rolled over for this idea until very recently, I really meant it, that they have accepted the idea that it's going to be converted from a publicly supported, taxpayer-supported good that serves the public interest as a whole. An educated society is a good society. An educated democracy is the only way you can have democracy in a complex society. And an educated society also helps each individual reach, as was said, their individual potential. But if instead you accept the idea that everything is to be cast into market terms and every individual is simply to obtain what they need for their own ends, and there is no such thing as a public good, then it makes sense to convert higher education itself to an entirely tuition-driven thing. And that's what's being rebelled against right now. In Occupy Wall Street, on the part of our students, on the part of more and more people. And I think that contradiction in the poll is actually really telling, because many people believe we should support public education. And at the same time, many people have attached to the idea that taxes themselves are a personal deprivation and no one should have to pay them.
I think that's
a really interesting
point, Wendy.
I just want to say
Wendy.
One more thing. That is what we call in education a teachable moment.
Yes.
And it is the moment that our leaders should seize to help develop a campaign in California that could close the gap between those two positions rather than just accepting it. And that's what I meant about a certain passivity until recently.
Excellent. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the crisis point in California's higher education. Joining me are Wei-Ming Dariotis, Assistant Professor of Asian American Studies and the President of the SFSU Chapter of the California Faculty Association, Wendy Brown, the Class of 1936 Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-chair of the Berkeley Faculty Association, and Laurel Rosenhall, who covers higher education for the Sacramento Bee. If you'd like to join us here, here's the number, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. If you're tuning in tonight, I am curious to hear from you. What would it take for you to change? Do you feel like my guests are saying that you've kind of changed, you know, assume that everything is kind of market-driven in the society, or are you, and you can't, and you associate taxes as something as theft, or are you not thinking that way? And if so, why? We'd like to hear from you this evening. Again, the number is 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So I want to kind of go back to what you all are saying. And, you know, Laura, let me bring you into this conversation again.
Sure.
With the study that you spoke of, were the people that were, you know, in this, was it a poll, or where did they actually, who did they talk to in this?
It's a survey done by the Public Policy Institute of California, and it's an annual survey that they do. They do a telephone survey of state residents, and they break out the different, you know, findings by party and by likely voter and et cetera. But the finding that I was talking about earlier is that, you know, 52% of the respondents said they're unwilling to pay higher taxes to maintain current funding for higher ed, even though large majorities, you know, ranging between 61% and 74%, kind of said all those concerns they had about the system.
And Wei-Ming, do you find it CSU that do you feel that, again, as I mentioned before, do you think a messaging could change this, or do you feel that the way they're trying to obtain students is really sending the message to the students that they are just, you know, a customer and this is really for their own good?
Well, clearly Chancellor Reed, the chancellor of the CSU system, has a very corporate view of what we do as educators. And I'm not sure that he has a view as an educator at all. Because it is so much focused on getting a certain value for dollar. For example, there's a new push to have students graduate at 120 units once they've reached that. That's pushing people out while they're one course away from achieving their second major, for example. All of these kinds of protocols that have been pushed down from us, from the chancellor's office onto the campuses, have really been focused on kind of getting as much bang for your buck as you possibly can out of the system. In other words, graduating as many bachelor's degrees as possible in as short as possible amount of time. But I think that it's important that we understand that this is a larger societal problem. This kind of individualist, pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality, I think, also has to do with race in our society. When the California Master Plan was first instituted in the 1960s, the racial composition of the state of California was very different from what it is now. And I think that that's part of the crisis. There's a certain sense that we are not all together as a society. There's this bifurcation and a sense of difference between groups that prevents us from deciding that we do, in fact, belong to the same society and that we benefit from being woven together. So I think that is a huge part of this crisis.
Okay. And Wendy, do you find that when you're talking about this, I mean, do you think that the commitment from the leadership to start not seeing it in such a business marketing terms, do you think that really could make a difference, or do you think that the universities are kind of so entrenched in thinking in this manner and getting their money this way that it will be really hard for them to change the way they can embrace a more public goods model and positioning and getting, going to bat for the students and the faculty?
That's a great question. I think we're in a colossal struggle over this very issue. It's important to remember that for nearly 100 years, Californians supported happily, generously, their public higher education system. And had the public higher education system that was not only the envy of the nation, but the envy of the world, people around the world not only looked to, the flagship campuses like Berkeley and UCLA as just stellar models for what you could do in delivering mass quality public education and doing first-class, world-class research, but they looked at the whole model and thought, this is it. This is how you educate a populace. And Californians themselves, until the 80s, were quite willing to support public education. So I don't think it's a question of it being a foregone conclusion that we are simply a market society and we will marketize everything. I think we're in a struggle over the question of what is appropriately marketized and what is not. We will not return to those glory days. That's clear enough. But right now, there are so many faculty, so many students, and I would say a good chunk of administrators, too, who are deeply committed to salvaging what remains of a first-class public education system.
Now,
and so I think we are in a struggle over it. I mean, on the one hand, we heard people like our president, Mark Udoff, and some of his assistants say many times over the past few years, don't worry about tuition increases. This place is still a bargain, and it's still cheaper than, our private peers. And we can still hike tuition quite a bit more before we reach a price point where we'll be in trouble. And they've been rewarding what they call entrepreneurial behavior. They've been setting up things for the chopping block that don't appear entrepreneurial. But there's been a rising up against that, and I think right now we are in a moment where we are struggling over the question that you've asked. Will we capitulate completely to a fully marketized institution, or will we be able to salvage something of a public institution? And I'll tell you what's at stake, besides things we've all mentioned at this point. Right now, students who come from families below $80,000 a year in annual income can still get federal assistance. Students above $180,000 a year can obviously still afford it. It's the middle class. It's exactly the class that Occupy Wall Street has risen up to yell about that is being systematically squeezed out of the University of California, pushed to the California State University system, which is now bulging beyond capacity, cannot take all the students that have been pushed there. The community colleges are also bulging. And what we are literally doing is breaking our commitment, the the master plan commitment to educate the top 12% of students in the state.
Wendy Brown, I need to stop you right here just to do a station identity.
Of course.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. If you're just tuning in, tonight we're discussing the crisis point in California's higher education. My guests this evening are Weiming Dariotis, the Assistant Professor of Asian American Studies and President of the SFSU chapter of the California Faculty Association, and Wendy Brown, the class of 1936 Professor of Political Science at University of California, Berkeley, and co-chair of Berkeley Faculty Association, and Laurel Rosenhall, who covers higher education for the Sacramento Bee. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I want to hear from listeners, whether you're a student, a teacher, or just someone that could benefit by having educated people in California with you. What would it take for you to engage and feel like you would want to go back to help supporting, through your tax dollars, the California higher education? Again, phone number is 415-841-4134, or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Wendy?
You know, I was thinking maybe it would be useful for your listeners to know just how much it would cost to restore public higher education. So just very briefly, if we were to roll back public funding to year 2000 levels, for the median taxpayer, it would cost approximately $50 a year in additional taxes. Now, the median taxpayer is not the average taxpayer, so that's just the 50% point, and many people are well below it. But if we were to just take somebody at, you know, $100,000 a year annual income, they would be paying just a couple of $100 a year to restore public higher education. Now, if you compare that to what they would pay to educate two children at the University of California in, say, 3 years when tuition is hiked another 22%, as it's guaranteed to be unless we get these funds, they would be spending $22,000 per year, per student, just for tuition and fees. So you see that educable moment that I mentioned earlier between what you're willing to put in taxes and what you believe in terms of public higher education? The first moment in that education could just be a little economics moment where you say, would you rather pay a couple hundred a year to sustain top quality public higher education in the state, or would you rather pay a total of $200,000 to get your kids educated at the University of California?
Wendy, you know, Wendy, I have to interrupt, and I do want to hear from my other two panelists, because one of the things seems to be one of the other issues on the table is accessibility. Because, you know, it's one thing to think, oh, I can support, but it's another thing to think, well, I really want to support so that my child can get it, but it's another thing to know, my child can definitely get into the system. And one of the issues, I understand, is that part of the budget issues has caused the schools to accept a lot less students, and a lot of the students that they are accepting are out of state.
That's right, 30% at Berkeley next year.
So, Weiming,
we're losing faculty in the CSU system as a result of this crisis. So some other numbers that might help listeners. Adjusted for inflation since 1998, faculty salaries have fallen 10%. The administrators, like the campus presidents and the chancellor's salaries, have gone up over 20%, including a $100,000 raise for newly hired campus presidents, like at UC San Diego. And student tuition and fees have gone up over 106%. Now, that's not even including the 9% fee increase that was just voted at last week's Board of Trustees meeting. It is really unconscionable to think about those numbers and to realize that it's not only about the squeeze on individual faculty, but what that means is that some faculty just cannot afford to do this work anymore. I certainly didn't know when I started teaching over 10 years ago that my salary would essentially not change in real numbers, but actually go down as a result of my buying power against the rate of inflation. And added to that, we took a 10% furlough, aka a 10% pay cut, in 2009, 2010, that frankly I'm still paying back the credit card debt from that year. So all in all, it's become unaffordable for many faculty even to continue to do this work, which means we've lost hundreds of faculty members as a result of this.
Why are you staying?
Why am I staying? I love teaching at San Francisco State. I love the students. I love my colleagues in the College of Ethnic Studies. And I'm fortunate to be in the largest Department of Asian American Studies anywhere in the country. So I get to teach this very specialized thing of mixed heritage Asian Americans. So I do love it. And I think that that's probably why most of the faculty who stay, stay, because they have a commitment to it. Honestly, it's hard work that doesn't feel like work because it is a joy. It's a joy. When you have students come to you and say that at the beginning of the semester, when they first enrolled in your composition course, that they thought they were so stupid that they, you know, just didn't even want to show you what they had written. And by the end of the semester, they tell you that they are eager to write their first book. You really can't trade that for anything. And particularly when you feel like you're giving people who feel like they don't have a voice of their own an opportunity to express themselves and to tell their story and to have a voice and make an impact on our society. You know, when I mentioned earlier this issue of the prison system, part of that was because of SF State has the only program for formerly incarcerated people to adapt to college. It's called Project Rebound. And through that program, I've met these incredible students who are superlative. I mean, when you hear them speak and you see their writing, they're writing at a graduate student level when they're undergraduates. And I'll never forget, you know, the student who told me that he didn't know how to use a computer because he'd been in jail for the last 10 years. And coming to know him and actually having him become a teaching assistant for me because he was so smart. And whenever I talk to him, I'd look into his eyes and I think to myself, this guy made it because he's so superior. How about every other person sitting in jail with him during his time who couldn't quite make that leap? How many other people are we losing in our society because we are failing to invest in them from the beginning?
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the crisis point in California's higher education. Joining me are Wei-Ming Dariotis, the Assistant Professor of Asian Studies at CSU and the President of the SFSU Chapter of the California Faculty Association, Wendy Brown, the Class of 1936 Professor of Political Science at University of California, Berkeley, and co-chair of the Berkeley Faculty Association, and Laurel Rosenhall, who covers higher education for the Sacramento Bee. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I want to take our first caller for the evening, Roberta. Welcome, Roberta.
Hi. That's a perfect segue, by the way, what you said about the loss of people who are sitting in prison. Because as a citizen, I've educated my child through whatever that got him his profession. But the resources that are lost, you look at Richmond schools, and you see who's sitting there, who if they had enough people looking at them, or if they had supply, I mean, it's pathetic. And it's heartbreaking that people won't agree to have a slight raise in their property tax. I don't know what there is to do about it. That seems to be the attitude.
Now, Roberta, are you an educator?
I'm sorry, am I an educator? No.
Okay.
I'm a mediator.
Okay.
I'd just like to point out that people are being taxed to support higher education, and those people are teachers and students. So when I took that 10% furlough, that was an $8,000 pay cut, essentially. And
I understand that.
Right.
The point is, you know, don't say it back to me. Assume we know that. Assume we know the waste there is. Now what? How do we convince people? I mean, if there's an election, you can go door to door and talk about how much this property tax county raise is going to benefit the kids. But people aren't buying it.
Thank you, Roberta, for the very passionate comment. And I agree. Let me ask Wendy. What do you think? Like, what do you think would have people buy it, if you will, just as Roberta's saying?
I think if you treat existing political discourse as just the given, as just the reality, as just all there is, then Roberta's absolutely right. There's no question that this is where people are right now. The question is, how do you change it? And this is why I keep bringing us back to Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street has already had the effect of making it possible in our national political conversations to talk about inequality in a way that we have not talked about it in 30 years. And I'm suggesting that we need to do the same sort of thing in local and state elections, in just what you mentioned, you know, going door to door, but also just talking, as Elizabeth Warren has talked about, as other people have talked about. What have we brought ourselves to by deciding that taxes are dangerous or are robbery? What state of near, as you put it, cratering in not just public education, but in all of our public goods have we brought ourselves to? And we have to, you know, it's not going to be an easy change, but it's the only thing we can count on, is to actually initiate a campaign that has at its heart the question of why we must tax ourselves for the things that we care about and value in this society. And it's not going to be an easy push, but there's no alternative.
So there
and
really is no alternative.
Wall Street has initiated it. It's given us a good kick. Go ahead.
When do you really feel, and you know, I'd love to hear from others too, but do you really feel there's really no alternative? It's taxes or nothing?
It's a combination of taxes and also reapportionment, right? I mean, the CSU system is not bankrupt, but the CSU chancellor's office chooses to put its money towards administrative raises rather than supporting faculty, with so little regard for the real conditions under which faculty are finding themselves teaching classes doubled in size, going to the office and finding that they no longer have any photocopy privileges, going to get a piece of paper even from a supply closet and having an administrative assistant follow them over there to make sure that only one piece of paper is taken, because that is how strapped we are for resources in our system. You know, so that is a priority thing, because we also know that our administrators are getting ridiculous raises, and we're not even getting the raise that we were promised in our last contract for work that we've already done, which really is wage theft, right? So I do think that the Occupy Wall Street movement is really significant for all of this, because it's showing us that there is a 1% that has the majority of the resources. And the CFA statewide president, Lil Tayes, when she spoke to the Board of Trustees last week, said this. She addressed them and said, you are the 1%, and the problem is that you have failed to recognize the relationship between all of us as a society, right? And I think up until now, there's been an illusion that we have a middle class that's made it. And only now are we starting to recognize that the middle class dream, the American dream, has eroded. And it's been eroded by this capitalist structure.
So this is Wendy again. Wendy's, we have a slight disagreement, but not a major one. I also think that the bloated salaries and benefits of the administrators at the top are not helping us, and they're certainly not helping our public image, and many of us have long called for those to stop. However, if they were redistributed, we would still have a problem.
That's, I agree with you.
So we need, there is no question that to reinvest in public education, we need state revenues, and to produce state revenues, as the caller Roberta said, we have to raise taxes. There is no alternative. Taxes are the basis of public goods. And this country has been on a road for the past 30 years of believing that it has to keep cutting taxes, both to satisfy the anti-tax revolt and out of an absolutely wrong-headed notion that cutting taxes stimulates the economy. No sane economist will actually make that argument. In California, ever since Prop 13, we have lived according to the idea that we can still have our wonderful, glowing, beautiful, magnificent, wealthy state and pay no taxes. And that's a child's illusion. So we have to address this issue, and we have to address the stranglehold that Prop 13 has on the possibility of raising revenues and having reasonable budgets, but we also have to address the simple mentality that you can have it all without paying for it.
And we have to look at the way that our state is... it is one of the wealthiest... I mean, if you look at it as a nation, it's one of the wealthiest nations in history.
That's correct.
And to think that we can't educate at a basic level the people of this state is a crime. You know, like I said, I went to school in San Francisco during the time that Proposition 13 was passed. I got lucky. My parents were able to pull me out of public school the next year and put me into the private school system. I went to University High School in San Francisco, which is, I would say, an educator of the elite, right, in general. One of my best friends went to McAteer High School, and he came to my high school graduation, and he asked me a whole bunch of questions that I didn't understand. How many people in your class are graduating? Everybody. How many of them are going to college? And I started listing. 5 are going to Stanford, 5 are going to Wesleyan, 3 are going to Yale. And then 2 weeks later, I went to his high school graduation, and I thought I should just ask him the same questions that he asked me. And I asked, how many people in your class are graduating? And he said 250. And I said, well, how many did you start with? 500. How many are going to college? And he said, about half of those who are graduating are going to some kind of college. I didn't even understand what he meant, because to me there was only one kind of college, 4-year private universities or the UC system, which was our backup. And when he told me that, you know, the majority of his classmates were going to community college or junior college, I didn't even know that existed, right? So when we talk about this gap of understanding, I think that that's a huge part of it, is that we don't really understand that, you know, I could walk down the hallway of my high school where we had classes limited to 12 students sitting around nice oak tables in beautifully appointed rooms with art on the walls. And my college counselor would say things to me like, Weiming, I see you at Princeton. I envision you at Princeton. Whereas my student, who I told you about earlier, who told me at the end of the semester that she wanted to write her first book, and actually she just got into graduate school at USF to become a teacher. I'm very proud of her. But when she first came to my class, she told me that she had never been advised to go to college, never been spoken to in her entire high school career about going to college, and in fact was told that college wasn't for her, and just stumbled into it herself. By luck, and by one person mentioning one time, maybe you should think about going to community college. And to me, it's stunningly short-sighted for us as a society to fail to put the energy into our youth and our future that we are doing. When we talk about tax cuts stimulating the economy, every time I hear that phrase, I just think, how much more could we stimulate our economy if we educated some people and taught them to become entrepreneurs?
Let me speaking of entrepreneurs, Laurel, I wanted to go to you. When you cover higher education, does the higher education include the privatized online universities?
Well, I'd actually like to just... I love San Francisco. It's where I was born and raised, and I was raised in the public schools in San Francisco for my entire K-12 career. I lived in San Francisco for much of my life, but I feel that I have to insert a little bit of political reality or observations into this conversation.
Yes, absolutely. Please do.
I've been in the state capitol for several years.
Yes.
You know, San Francisco is a fantastic place full of very thoughtful people and very caring people who are looking out for the greater good. San Francisco is not representative or typical of California. And I think that the professors are a little bit short-sighted if they think that simply getting the university leadership to make a speech or have a meeting with Jerry Brown is going to make all the difference. The political reality is very stark. It takes a 2/3 vote of the legislature to raise taxes. the legislature, neither house of the legislature, is two-thirds Democrat. There's not a Democrat in the Capitol who wouldn't love to give more money to the schools. It's just not a political reality. So I think that all of the conversation about kind of changing public attitudes is relevant and is definitely a poignant way to think about it. It doesn't seem to me to be very boots on the ground politically real.
And Laura, what from your perspective, what do you think would be more boots on the ground?
Targeting the districts. I mean, finding the districts where there are Republicans who could, you know, possibly be replaced. I mean, it's just a numbers game. And you know, even when we had the ballot initiative that changed the legislature's ability to pass a budget by a simple majority vote instead of needing a two-thirds vote for that, you know, they didn't do, the proponents of that didn't tag along with it tax increases at a simple majority vote. They kept it with tax increases at a two-thirds vote because their polling showed that if the ballot measure included taxes at a simple majority vote, it wouldn't pass. So, anyway, just had to add that.
Yeah, well, no, appreciate that. Wendy.
Respect for my hometown of San Francisco.
Wendy Brown, do you have something to give a rebuttal?
Sure. I have two things. One, I was born and raised in Modesto, California. I know the Central Valley extremely well. I am not speaking from a Bay Area perspective. When I say that the leaders of higher education in this state need to launch a campaign, I'm not talking about a meeting with Jerry Brown. I'm talking about a campaign to change the hearts and minds of Californians about how you sustain the life you value and love. And the life that Californians value and love from right to left is one in which there are educated rather than criminal citizens, in which there are parks and schools and clean water and clean air. There is huge disagreement politically, ideologically, about how you get these things. But the task of the stewards of higher education in this state is to help explain how you sustain and keep the California that so many people treasure from right to left. It's not a question of just yielding to the polls. It's a question of changing how those polls end up.
Wendy, I think you make a good point in terms of getting right to the heart of, or keeping that heart in mind. Let me go to Miguel. We have Miguel, who's a student on the line. Good evening, Miguel.
Hi, good evening.
You're a student?
Yes, I'm a student at CSU East Bay.
Mm-hmm.
Double major in ethnic studies and Spanish.
And did you call with a comment or a question?
A comment. Uh-huh. I just want to comment about my education and in terms of the fee increase.
Tell us more about your situation.
Okay. First of all, I would like to say that personally, the tuition fee increase has been affecting me since I am an AB 540 student here on campus. Just to let the audience know, AB 540 is a law that passed in 2001 in California that allows undocumented students to pay in-state tuition when applying to college. And so when I entered CSU East Bay, I used to pay $1,270, and that was fall in 2008. And now, like in this year, fall 2011, now I have to pay $2,133. And since the additional 9% increase for next year, I think I will have to pay tuition like around $2,500, which is insane, you know?
Now, if they had, if they were to stop it right now, would it be okay in terms of the tuition increase, or is it like too much, too little, too late?
Yeah, it's already like too much. Like I think I'll have to drop out. And this is my fourth year, and I cannot afford tuition, you know, so I need to get, like, private scholarships in order to go to college. And I see, like, a lot of my AB 540 friends from campus, they are already dropped out because tuition it's out of the rules, you know.
Okay. Miguel, thank you so much for sharing your story. Weiming, is this a common story that you hear all the time?
Yes, it is. And unfortunately, you know, we don't always hear the story because sometimes those students have just left the system. But I can certainly say, having taught at SF State for more than a decade, that the student population has shifted significantly. Like many other campuses, SF State is impacted, which means that for students outside of our local service area, they will have to meet a higher level in order to be accepted at our campus. And so the students that we're seeing are not necessarily the transfer students, the older students who have struggled and made their way. We're seeing a lot more first-time freshmen. We're seeing people from slightly wealthier families, and I would even say that we're seeing people who are pushed down from the UC system. They're not getting into the UCs because rather than building new college campuses, the state has invested in building new penitentiaries, right? And so they're no longer able to get into the UC system. They're coming to the CSU. That's pushing out the traditional CSU students. So overall, there's been a shift, and I'd say that there's been a loss as a result. I did also want to mention, in response to your other guest's comments, that I think that boots on the ground is actually exactly the description of what's been going on our college campuses over the last couple of weeks, particularly the strike at Cal State East Bay and Cal State Dominguez Hills, where we practically shut down both of those campuses. I was at East Bay for 12 hours on Thursday, and we had hundreds of people, including Cornell West, come and join us and talk to us about, you know, what it meant that we were actually there trying to change the views not only of our administration but of the general public. And we know that it's not an easy campaign, and frankly, this was just the first step in what will probably be a much longer and a much harder campaign. But it's one that we're prepared for, in the same way that my colleagues who founded the College of Ethnic Studies through, you know, months and months and months of student strikes 40 years ago were prepared to do, because doing this now makes a change for the better for the future. And I know that some people have criticized us for not doing our job for a day. And I have to say that I am, you know, we work all the time. Faculty do not get months off during the summer, as people, I think, kind of imagine that we do. We do not get these long breaks. We are constantly working. The weekends, the evenings, we're always working. And for me, it's an imperative that we do this kind of work as role models for our students, because I want my students to know that when they are faced with an injustice, it is their right and responsibility as members of this society to stand up and say no more.
The teachable moment in action.
Exactly.
Let me just, this is a fantastic way. Unfortunately, we could talk about this all night, but we are at the top of the hour. So those are wonderful final words. Let me go to you, Laurel, and then you, Wendy, for, again, your final words, and maybe what's next? And when I say final words, I mean literally, unfortunately, maybe a sentence or two about what you think is next. Laurel?
Oh, well, I think that there's going to be a lot of focus on the police presence on the campuses, given what we've seen both at UC Berkeley and UC Davis, and also at the Cal State Trustees meeting last week, which we didn't even get a chance to talk about, where there was an enormous clash between protesters and police. So I do think the conversation, as the guest pointed out early in the show, is a little bit shifting away from the issues at the center of the protest to how law enforcement is dealing with it.
Great.
And I just want to thank you for refocusing the conversation on issues of privatization and public higher education, because I think most of the protesters in the end are struggling for public higher education, and as I think the police issues actually are will probably wind up and die down shortly. And what I am concerned about is that the protests not do that, because I think They have raised the issue of public education for the public. Thank you for doing this.
Yes, Wendy, thank you. And thank you, Waming Dariotis. And thank you, Laurel Rosenhall, my guest for this evening. I really appreciate your being a part of this program. City Visions tonight was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Thank you, Lisa. And was our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Thank you, Eric. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Judith Sanson is our senior producer, and the other contributing producers are Matt Fidler and Susie Britton. Next week, we will be off from City Visions due to Thanksgiving, but we want to wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening. This is Lauren Meltzer. Good night.